Well, 8 people are in custody today in Tunisia, suspected of being involved in last week's mass shooting in the resort town of Sousse. 38 people were killed. 30 of them were British tourists. And then there's the toll the attack has taken on the economy and democracy in Tunisia. William Lawrence heads the Middle East and North Africa programs at the Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy. Welcome.
Hello.
And you have spent a lot of time in Tunisia and studied it for many years. What was your reaction to the news of the attacks on Sousse just a few months after the attacks on the Bardo Museum in Tunisia?
Well, I was horrified. This is the worst attack in modern Tunisian history, the worst attack on Britons in 10 years, and the worst attack on tourists since the 97 attack in Luxor. So we hadn't really seen this level of violence. But those of us that study Tunisia and Libya knew things were coming. There's a lot of instability in Libya. There's a lot of young Tunisians traveling overseas for training and attracted by the various struggles going on. And it was bound to come back and hit Tunisia again.
And what is the effect, do you think, on Tunisia? And we remember that this is the country that started the Arab Spring, and this is the only country in the entire Arab Spring where the new leader that they put in place after the Arab Spring is still there.
Well, there's going to be a lot of effects on Tunisia, some positive, some negative. There's a crackdown already going on. They've closed 80 mosques. There's crackdowns on civil society. And the sort of reflex of the Tunisian government to act in authoritarian manners after an incident like this, it's going to possibly push more Tunisians into radicalization. So Tunisia needs to find the right balance, and the international community needs to step up and support Tunisia, which is going to be hit hard too economically. They're projecting a loss of $500 million of tourism receipts this year in a country that was already borrowing money to pay government salaries.
Well, and how important is tourism in Tunisia?
Huge. I mean, officially it's 7% of the GNP. With related sectors, it's been estimated at 15%. In the summertime, it's basically the only thing going. And Tunisia prides itself on its sort of proximity to Europe, both in terms of the millions of Europeans who visit to be tourists, but also who come and invest in Tunisia. And there's thousands of, for example, joint ventures, small businesses between Tunisia and Europe, which will also suffer as Europeans stop traveling to Tunisia.
But you think that despite all of that and despite what's at stake for Tunisia's economy because of this, it was an overreaction to do what the government did and shut down all these mosques?
I think that was they needed to do something, right? And there were the 13 measures they announced, and those were predictable. I think what's really important is what they do going forward. The majority of young people weren't interested in voting in the democratic elections last fall. The majority of young people are still susceptible to ISIS propaganda, like some young people in the United States who are lost or confused or in difficult circumstances. And so what the government does now to engage young Tunisians, to get them invested in their communities, in their futures, to the degree they can get them jobs or projects they can work on, they'll be able to bring to fruition the promise of the Tunisian revolution. But the degree to which the youth are vilified and seen as the enemy and marginalized, including closures of organizations, closures of mosques, shutting down avenues for free speech, that's going to be a real problem.
You've lived in Tunisia and Morocco and studied the entire region. What sets Tunisia apart in terms of history and culture? As I look at it from the outside, it appears that Tunisia is a kind of a more European country than some of the other countries in North Africa.
Well, it always was. It was closest to Europe in many ways. And famously, the founding president of Tunisia got on television during Ramadan and drank a glass of orange juice and talked about how if Tunisia was going to develop, they needed to maybe not fast Ramadan. I mean, this was very much the type of action that caused the backlash among believing Muslims and the Islamic community in Tunisia to want to sort of reestablish Tunisia's Islamic identity after the revolution. And so there's a real tension in Tunisian society about what is authentic. Is authentic, you know, being more conservative in terms of Islam, or is authentic Tunisianism being more European and being more Mediterranean? And this has played out in the last couple of elections in Tunisia, and it's not settled yet, except insofar as they have an amazing constitution they passed a year ago. And that harks to another aspect of Tunisian history. It was the first Arab country with a constitution going back to 1864. They have a long history of a strong legal system and a kind of consensus about freedoms that are important for society to work well. And so It'll be interesting going forward to what degree they're able to protect those basic freedoms that all Tunisians agreed on with the passage of the Constitution.
And do you think they'll be able to hold on to that and not fall into disarray the way that Libya has and other countries in the region?
If the political coalition in power manages to hang on in a strong way and is stable, and if Tunisia gets the economic support it needs internationally, there's a good chance. But Tunisia's really on the brink right now, and Tunisia could go the other way. And certainly what's going on in Libya and in the region is very negatively affecting Tunisia. Tunisia sent the biggest number of fighters, young people, to fight in Syria and Iraq with ISIS. Some of those fighters are returning. Now, this is interesting. Hundreds of the fighters who returned are disillusioned because they went to fight a dictator and they got swept up in a sectarian conflict or killing civilians or whatever. But they come back to Tunisia and they fall into, in many cases, the same misery and the same predicaments they were in that propelled them to leave. And then those are people with choices that need to be made. And that's where the government and others that provide services, the NGO community, need to kind of step in and provide more for people who are on the fence about, you know, whether to be violent revolutionaries or whether they're going to buy into the fruits of the revolution.
And what about the U.S.? Is there more the U.S. should be doing to protect the integrity of the government in Tunisia?
Absolutely. I mean, Tunisia needs probably $5 billion of international support. We recommended the U.S. invest $800 million. You know, there's a lot of resistance in Washington for any kind of assistance to any country. But democracy is cheap. What we spend for military interventions internationally is ridiculously expensive compared to what it costs to support a democratic transition in a country like Tunisia. And all it takes is a certain amount of programs and transparency, supporting accountability. And it can all be done in ways that are accountable because Tunisia has a strong civil society now that can track how money is spent. And they publish it all on Twitter and websites. So you can do assistance to Tunisia in a way that is not corrupt. And really, it's the best way to, I think, spend U.S. Money overseas.
That's William Lawrence, who directs the Middle East and North Africa programs at the Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy. That's a think tank in Washington. William Lawrence, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.